Auto insurance can all seem the same until it comes time to use it. So don't get stuck paying more for less coverage. Switch to USAA Auto Insurance and you could start saving money in no time. Get a quote today. Restrictions apply.
You may know you're listening to this show along the Marketing Podcast Network, but did you know there are other great shows on MPN to help your business? Christy Hyler hosts a fantastic podcast called Own It. Christy, tell us more about the show.
Own It is all about celebrating women and non-binary advertising agency owners. We talk about buying out of the Boys Club of Advertising because less than 1% of ad agencies are owned by women.
And where can people subscribe?
You can find the podcast at untilyouownit.com. We're also on the Marketing Podcast Network at marketingpodcast.net. And of course, you can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
You heard her. Go subscribe.
I'm Nick Westergaard, and this is On Brand, helping you tell your story. My guest this week is David Lemley.
The brand has changed from goods and services to a building block of personal identity. And so we want to be a better citizen. So we want brands to be citizens to help us solve more complex problems with our life and the world.
David helps brands become legendary. David is the president and chief strategist of Retail Voodoo, a U.S.-based brand strategy firm that helps specialty food and beverage brands gain market share by addressing their toughest growth challenges. Armed with a passion for ideology-driven companies and over 25 years of industry experience, David sets the standard for all research, brand strategy, brand positioning, and marketing translation for the firm. Clients include Essentia Water, Kind Healthy Snacks, Surla Table, and Dry Soda Company, and Alden's Organic Ice Cream. David, welcome to On Brand.
Thanks, Nick. I'm glad to be here.
You know, everyone knows that I'm a big word nerd, and when the word voodoo is in your brand name, I have to start there. Tell me what drew you to voodoo. Even though I realize that sounds like a funny way to phrase the question, I could be open to the fact that maybe it is just original OG voodoo that made you drop it into the retail space.
That's a good way to characterize that. So Retail Voodoo actually has been around for a long time. I started a design firm many, many, many moons ago. And we developed a process that came out of our work with Starbucks Coffee. And when we were done, there were myself and many people from within Starbucks, and many people have gone on to become legends. And we were standing around saying, what the heck did we just do? And we realized that we were on the front end of brand strategy. So I, rather than being, hey, this is great, let's go do this forever, got really, really scared. So I went back to school. So I went to business school after design school. And I codified what we did and named it way back in the 90s, Retail Voodoo. So, but that's not what my agency was called back then. It was named after me. So later, when I got a partner and we decided to narrow our focus to only focus on do-gooders and help the people trying to disrupt the food system by bringing clean ingredients to the foreground and getting this whole thing about health and wellness and fitness into the game, we dropped my name and put the Retail Voodoo moniker up. And so that's how we came to it. And what we found is that the name, for people who are in the space, it provokes a dialogue. If as a brand, you're supposed to get people to say, hey, tell me more, Retail Voodoo is a very successful in that arena because everybody says, are you going to poke me with a pan? Or, you know, like, what is it? And it's really the combination of, it's the joke of, you know, creative and strategy has some dark art to it. And that's where it came from way back in the day. Today, we are incredibly data-driven. So we actually call the distillation of the data into something that is going to work for people and to get into deep insight around human need. That's the voodoo part.
Well, I was worried about the pinpricking thing, but it's a virtual conversation, so I thought I would end up unscathed there. You know, I want to talk about your industry because I think that that's fascinating, but I wonder first if I could touch on something that you just said, and that's really about our industry, that being marketing firms, professional service firms, and that transition that I think many navigate because history tells us you put your name on the door. And I think there is something to this idea of starting the conversation with that name, with that idea, that is something that almost serves you better than the history of marketing service firms that are, you know, named after all three partners or one partner. I've done the same thing myself, but I got tired of saying I'm Nick Westergaard from Westergaard.
Exactly. So I think that is part of it. It's a tired thing. When you're first starting out, there's a lot of energy and juju around it, and you say, hey, I am proud that my name's on the door, and there's something to that, and it comes out of a long heritage. Architects, all sorts of professional services firms have done that over the history, so the marketing world just followed suit. And what I think happens is you end up, if you grow and you're successful and you start to network across the country or beyond, you end up with four or five names all mashed together, and then it just becomes this challenging thing. And again, it's a different point of view, where if we all believe that a brand name is an empty vessel that you pour meaning into, naming it after yourself or your dog or whatever is fantastic. But in a hyper-competitive world where everybody looks amazing on the internet, and whether you're one or two people or 300 people, it's hard for clients to tell the difference unless they have something, a provocative name or a name that starts to deliver or hint at what you're promising is really differentiating.
Well, that's such an important point. And I think naming is one of those brand touch points that it's easy to overthink and underthink, but it definitely deserves some thought. So in talking about what led you here, you mentioned your work at Starbucks and that being such an iconic brand. And I mentioned that at the end of the show, we'll ask for a brand that has made you smile recently. And I have to point out that I have not formally, I'm not data-driven as you are in tallying up the most smiled brands, but Starbucks has to be up there, and it's such a big brand. So talk about your work behind the scenes of this brand.
Well, it's funny because I will say that I'm a super fan of the brand today, and even yesterday they had somebody who was retired after serving in the company for 25 years, who started as a barista, who ended up being at headquarters. And the way they managed it, and even Howard Schultz Skyped in to say goodbye to the guy, and it was a big thing on television. That's the kind of nurturing the human spirit that they're all about, that I really appreciate and love. And so it's 20 years since I've touched the brand, or not quite 20 years, but it's in there. So I was fortunate enough to be one of the kids that was brought in when they decided to go from 800 stores and build a store a day forever. And they brought in a gentleman named Scott Bedbury from Nike and a guy named Wright Massey from Disney. And they brought our firm in, and we sort of went nuts. And in this whole idea of let's create something that no one has ever done and built and redefine what the coffee experience is and how it can plug into first popular culture and then into universal culture. And so that was the assignment. How do we do that and make it so that we're not bored? And so we were fortunate enough to do exactly what we do now every day, but it was completely new, where it was about getting the right people enrolled in the changes that were going to happen and making sure that there was a long runway for each radical thing that we were needing to do, and then bringing it was data, customer intel. It was very primitive in the 90s, but that's still what we were using to make the decisions we did. And so I was fortunate enough to be one of the leads and one of the heads of the teams that created that whole thing that ran for 12 or 14 years without a change, that their in-house team went from 8 people to hundreds of people using the toolbox we helped build.
So I think that you hit on something that it's easy to forget about, and probably why Starbucks is such a smiled brand. But at the beginning, you talked about how do you make this something that plugs into everyday life. And it's easy to forget that coffee, and not just kind of this normalized what coffee used to be. I don't know. I can't think of, I'm sure maybe you know a category name, but it's like special coffee wasn't a thing 20 years, right back when you were talking about. So what kind of things did you put in a toolbox to make it a part of people's lives?
Well, the first thing we did was work with words and concepts and rituals. And so we were able to take the, Howard Schultz had the idea of ritualizing the Italian coffee experience for Americans. That was the, break it down from that true, pure, ancient tradition to something that everybody could get into. So we began with words, believing that reality exists in language. We started with, well, what is this all about? And how can we ritualize it in a way where people will make it theirs? And that concept I just described to you is pretty normal today. I think all brands and all passion brands or all purpose-focused brands are aspiring to do that. Any brand with a truly big idea behind it is really after that. But back then, we were saying, okay, the only way to ritualize this is to change people's definition of what it is, because the big question is, how do you go from, at that point in time, coffee cost 99 cents at the most, and the leading brands that the data from back then, the leading brand was Uban, and that craft coffee or gourmet coffee, as the category is called, just didn't really exist. It wasn't even the grocery channel yet. There were a few local onesie twosie bags that were crazy, but there was no because I know all about this because we worked with them to get into the grocery channel as part of the strategy, as a way to create a ritual where you would have an experience in the grocery store and you would have an experience with the brand where it would see you in your bunny slippers at home. And then when you went back in the cafe, the conversation will have changed. And so that was part of what we did, is that's how you ritualize it. Make it so that I want to customize it. I want to own it. The idea of mass customization, which is also very buzzy and very now, that's what it was about back then.
Are you enjoying this conversation about branding? If so, I'd love to bring my Brand Now keynote speech to your next conference or corporate event. Based on my popular book, Brand Now, this talk breaks down the 7 dynamics of building a standout brand in our crowded, distracted world. Entertaining and educational, your audience will learn, laugh, and leave with ideas they can implement right away. Learn more, including watching video and viewing popular presentation topics, at nickwestergaard.com/speaking. That's nickwestergaard with 2 A's .com/speaking. Now back to the show. So I would imagine that once you do something like that, once you build a brand of this level, that that's something that other people wanted as well as you left for your next venture. Talk a bit about that journey.
Yeah, so it did that particular project, because it was such a huge success, put our brand on the map and helped us get people to return the phone calls, which was kind of a miracle. It didn't happen overnight. It took a couple of years, but it did happen. And that also led me to why I went back to school, because I did not have a map and nobody who was there had a map. And everybody was kind of looking around going, whew, what did we do? That was really cool. It kind of was like that feeling of when you've gone and had a bachelor's weekend that goes along, and at the end you all had this really amazing experience and you laugh about it and you cry about it and you're besties forever, and yet you don't quite remember exactly what happened. So that's why I took the 2 years back in school to go codify and interview people and rebuild the map so that I had one. And after building the map, we have used it several hundred times, and it works for any kind of an organization.
So where does that map lead you to borrow the metaphor. Couldn't resist.
No, that's good. So where does it lead you? So it's super interesting. And I geek out on charts and graphs, but it's really about there's a building a brand strategy as sort of the part of your organization that's under the iceberg. It's the deep part of the iceberg that the world sees your marketing communication and the way in which you're going to keep your promises. That's what's above the waterline. But what's below the waterline is where all of the heavy lifting comes in. And it's really getting clear about the body or the physical tangible assets of the universe that you're going to play in, which includes making sure you understand what your competitive advantages are and mapping today's audience and tomorrow's audience and 5 years from now audiences, and then figuring out who's competing for those and what other experiences or what other rituals they have in their life that are going to compete for that time and attention. So that's one side. And then the other side is really getting into the psychology of the organization. So the mental part of it. So the culture of the organization is huge for this, because if they're not ready to make a change, or you have dissenters, or there's hidden decision makers or anything like that that could derail the project, you need to get them out in the light and enroll them in the project, or it's not going anywhere.
Is it safe to say that most of us are over-indexing on what's happening above the waterline?
Yeah, I think that's really safe to say, because it's all the stuff. In fact, I would say most of us are over-indexing in today's world on the very tippy-toppy tree growing above the waterline, which is social. But we can talk about that or not talk about it.
No, well, I think those are things – those are most of what we talk about each week. I always feel like it's kind of a group therapy for branding and marketing professionals, because it's hard stuff. But the tippy-top tree, the social stuff – that's an easy lever to pull, and we can, and it's hard to do the stuff that you talked about below the waterline. Culture is not a box to check. That's a big process and a conversation. So I think that's why sometimes we gravitate up into those trees of social, but it's really that hard work is where the big change happens.
Yeah, in the culture is where it happens, making sure you have the right people who want to be there. We call it right butt in right seat with the right aptitude, making sure that's happening and making sure that the history and the passion and the vision is shared and adhered to and bought into by all. And again, it's not sexy like social or like an in-store experience or a digital experience. It's the heavy lifting that makes all that other stuff rich and powerful. But you got to get that done first. Otherwise, no matter how good your competitive advantage and your onlyness and your positioning statement is, it's just going to lie flat or be mistranslated as people try to scat with it. What we say a lot in our organization is we want to write the first version of the song, but that we want to teach everybody to sing it, and then everybody in that organization needs to be able to scat with it.
Did you say scat with it?
Yeah. So
I just wanted to make sure I had it correctly. So like vocal improvisation.
Exactly. So scatting is classic jazz move when you don't know the words. That's how it was invented. You know, back in the day, the invention of scatting was, I don't know the words, I'm just going to go with the song. And now it's become an art form, which is, I'm going to make up my version of the words and get the same emotion and meaning across to you.
That is such a, it's an interesting way to talk about this work, because we hear, we get to culture or probably every other episode here in some way or another. But that version and really setting up what our job is, because I think sometimes we get into the culture and we think, is this really what I as a branding and marketing professional do? But I think that distribution of responsibility of writing the song, but making sure it's something that other people can work with. And I think that variation, to really go deep on your metaphor, which maybe isn't what you intended, we often talk about making sure everybody has the hymnal to sing from. I think that's the singing metaphor that is often applied, and there's not a lot of flexibility in sing from my hymnal.
It's really true. And we were just having a conversation yesterday about this exact concept. So think of a brand standards or a voice standards guide that gets delivered by a marketing firm to the client. And the more rigid and the more shackle-like it is, the stronger it will be. What we found is that if we don't create enough deviance in the language portion, that it ends up falling flat. It ends up not being adopted by all. And what happens typically in an organization is you have leadership, you have marketing, and then you have operations, and you have all sorts of different things. And then in many organizations, you have frontline employees, or you have people that are out in the street doing the touching humans part of the brand. And if you don't get all of those people on the same page and deliver the message in a way that's meaningful for them, it falls flat. This reminds me actually of a really cool story. Nike came to us and said, why for no people at Nike Town and the Nike owned stores? And when we do something as an event, they don't bleed Nike like we do at headquarters. And it turned out to be a language problem. And the insight was, everybody who works at Nike Town is on their way somewhere else. They're either an athlete or a student or a young adult who doesn't want to read a 500-page manual to understand the thing. And yet at headquarters, you read the 500-page manual, and then you'd be able to give a 90-minute PowerPoint about it. That's normal for the culture. So what we were able to do was take several 500-page manuals and turn them into one sentence each called the gist. And that's how we reset that culture so that the young folks who are on their way somewhere else who want to buy into Nike get to plug in, be part of it, feel smart, and keep it with them when they move on.
So those are employees that the gist was designed for?
Yeah, it was designed for people who are not at corporate.
Well, yeah, because when you're at the corporate level, there's probably much more stock put into, I need to synthesize all of this into what it means to me and how I can live that. And that's, I would say, probably there's some concentric circles happening in any organization where you've got that level of commitment right at the center. But as you radiate outward, that commitment might vary or need to be addressed more.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. In the marketing department or the marketing leadership, more is better. And then translating that across to the C-suite, more is better. They don't want to know it all, but they want to know that it's been done. And for finance team, they want to know what it's going to cost and that it's concise and that it will be able to be replicated. Everyone else needs a much shorter version.
So true that you need a handle that you can grab onto as a team member, regardless of where you're at.
Yeah, it's the key. Again, our philosophy is reality exists in language. If we can get everybody to mean the same thing, even though they might say it 20 different ways, we have built a religion or our brand.
So at the risk of starting something among our listeners, I feel like we spend a great deal of time on various episodes hearing from B2B brand builders, and there's the kind of woe is me B2B that it's a challenging space to operate in. And I think that sometimes there's maybe a subtle vibe that B2C, like say food and beverage, is such an easy land to live in. But you talk about addressing some of those tough growth challenges. What does that space look like?
It is freak show competitive for any brand playing in the space. There can only be one beloved and dominant leader in a category, and a set of or a consideration set around that if it's not available. Everyone else is scratching the tree trying to climb it. And so there are brand, I mean, it's also right now, because the world has caught on to, oh, what we put in our bodies has an impact on, you know, you put good in, you get good out. So if you're going to think about what you're eating, there's this whole natural, better for you, organic thing. And everybody's in the space trying to play with that. And for the last, I want to say, 10 years, it's been very earnest, and you have to check all the boxes and figure out how to make magic and how to make people want to buy into that. In the last 18 to 24 months, all of the technology VCs have turned their eyes to food. And so there it's the Wild West. You've got people saying, yeah, my brand is 6 months old and I have this unbelievable budget to try to climb this mountain right now. Let's go. And so it's this idea where the baseline of the category was either all about scale or all about disrupting somebody else's scale. And now you have this thing in the middle where values are questionable, despite the fact that humans need them more than ever. So it's a very weird place to play right now.
Well, I think your overall focus is fascinating because you're in this space, which, as you acknowledged, is changing, is challenging. But then also, you mentioned early on talking about focusing on do-gooders. And I think there's a connection there with what you just said about we care about what we're putting in our bodies. We're also, we care more about who the company is that we're buying from, that we're supporting. And that's very different for brands.
It is. And that whole transparency is that's the buzzword. Transparency, because of social media and that most people walk around with their phone plugged into their forehead, you can find anything out about anybody at any given point. And so you better not try to put a spin on something that is less than positive, and you better not try to make up a story that isn't real that can be unwoven through the internet. So people are needing that. It's also because of social and because of the dopamine that comes from the phone, people are hungrier and looking for meaning and story more than ever. You know, humans are hardwired to make up stories as part of our survival mechanism. Even if there's not one there, we're going to make it up. That's where the whole idea of archetypes come from, is we can all, because we're hardwired, find one of 12 main characters running around in any story, even if we're hallucinating the story. So that's part of it. But in today's modern sort of weaponized web, I don't see a lot of humans. I interact with them over digital, and I can find anything I want in any given second. The brand has changed from goods and services to a building block of personal identity. And so we want to be a better citizen. So we want brands to be citizens to help us solve more complex problems with our life and the world.
And we did not used to have that on our to-do list as brand builders. Nobody cared what happened at the home office or anywhere else. But now, yeah, with that transparency, you have to walk your talk.
Yes, as a marketer, the role of a marketer has changed so radically in the last several years that I always say I'm a student of marketing. I'm not yet a marketer, because I think I'm learning so much on a daily basis that I can't believe how dumb I was yesterday.
I thought as you went into that, I thought that's a great approach to learning. But then I think it's also the state of where we're all working. Anyone who's listening to this podcast has the same context, that anybody who thinks that they know everything is not seeing the whole picture.
Yeah. Or we need to hang out with them and be schooled.
Exactly. Yeah, maybe they found it. They figured it out.
Yeah.
I'll try to figure out who they are and have them on next week.
Okay.
David, as we start to wrap up here, what is a brand that has made you smile? Talking about a building block of the personality, what's a building block of your personality that's a brand?
A building block of my personality that is a brand actually is Bulletproof. And they are sort of the biohacker's spirit guide brand, if you will. They make me smile a lot because they allowed me to put butter and coconut oil in my coffee. And it wakes up my brain in the morning in a completely different way than has ever happened. So they make me smile a lot. And I like their education platform. I feel like I can learn how to hack my nutrition without having to be a nutritionist or a rocket scientist. And they make it very fun and friendly.
And what you just outlined, if for those that weren't distracted by the wonder that is butter in coffee, but what you just said though talks about what you get out of that. It's not just a transaction. Your sense of self. You have a different. You are allowed to. You become the biohacker, and because of them.
Yeah, they have helped me change the rituals around my morning, and actually change the rituals around several parts of my day. It started with butter and coffee in the morning, which is an amazing thing if you've never done it. I highly recommend trying it. But the rest of it, thinking about how much screen time I use and how I communicate or don't communicate through technology with my children and my wife, these are huge things. And like, wait, a brand taught me that? Yeah, they did. Or they have opened my eyes to think about that as part of making myself have more inner strength and more physical strength and more mental acuity, taking care of that, those relationships. And so that, again, that's really going deep quickly, but that is when a brand can do that, that's the magic where they have overcome price. They have overcome every other option. And if I can get a bulletproof product, I will favor them despite price, because I appreciate everything else they've done for me.
Impact on identity. Well said. David, where can folks go to learn more about who you are and what you do?
You can head on over to retailvoodoo.com and check it out. That's probably the best place.
Awesome. Well, we will link up to all of that in our show notes. Thanks for being on brand with us.
Nick, it was a really fun conversation. I appreciate you having me on.
And as a reminder, you can find those show notes, links, and more at onbrandpodcast.com. If you like what you're hearing, remember to subscribe to the show via Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, or wherever you like to listen. And please take a moment and rate and review the podcast to help others find the show. For more on me, including how you can sign up for my In Case You Missed It newsletter, please visit nickwestergaard.com. That's Westergaard with two A's. Until next week, I'm Nick Westergaard, and I'll see you on the internet.
This podcast is heard along the Marketing Podcast Network. For more great marketing podcasts, visit marketingpodcasts.net.